on the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're opening up a story that, well, it really blends that unsettling Southern Gothic feel with some meticulous true crime details.
And a mystery, a really potent one.
Exactly. It clings to the air in Savannah, Georgia. We're stepping into the dark, almost intoxicating world of Clara Merrow.
The legendary perfumer.
Yes. Famous locally for these just mesmerizing scents, but far more notoriously known for something else.
The seven husbands who vanished suddenly, conveniently.
Right. And we aren't really easing into this one, are we?
No, not at all. Our source material, it basically drops us straight into 1954 Savannah. Mm. And it doesn't, you know, give us any kind of gentle introduction.
It hits hard from the start.
It really does. The initial take is stark, almost breathless, like pure judgment. One quote from back then just lays it out. What this woman did to her husbands was far beyond evil.
Wow. Okay.
So we have to admit, right up front, we're navigating a story that's built on, well, moral outrage, maybe some hyperbole.
Which means we've got to try and separate the legend from, you know, the actual legal reality.
That's the job.
And that separation, that's exactly our mission for this deep dive. Mm-hmm. We need to unpack this timeline, which is highly sensationalized. It swings wildly, doesn't it?
Yeah, from like high society acclaim one minute.
To finding these hidden, just terrifying caches of evidence the next.
Mm.
We need to grasp the facts, sure, but also how the myth itself almost became a character in the story. Maybe even a weapon.
And to do that, we have to go beyond just listing dates. We need to focus on these core, really chilling ideas that Clara Merrow's story brings up. Preservation.
And possession.
Exactly. So the analysis means telling apart the serial myth, the story the town was telling, from the actual verifiable police evidence.
And then there's that escape theory later on.
Right. We need to see how scent became this kind of archive and how marriage turned into this cycle of extraction.
Okay, so let's dive in. Let's start with the atmosphere she built around herself. Okay, let's paint the picture. Imagine standing in Savannah. It's summer 1954. The heat is just thick. Oppressive, right?
Mm-hmm. Humid. You can smell the jasmine, the salt from the marshes.
Yeah. And then you step inside Clara Merrow's boutique, and she's this figure, you know, sophisticated, a bit mysterious, and her perfumery is doing incredibly well.
Hugely successful, but unusual.
Right.
Highly unusual.
It wasn't like she was just selling, I don't know, nice floral water. She was selling this profound, intoxicating aura. It was like marketing a magnet, pulling people right into her world.
And what's immediately striking when you look at the accounts is how they describe the product. It's not the usual stuff.
No light, sweet florals that you'd expect for, you know, 1950s femininity.
Not at all. Her scents, they're consistently described as warm, heavy, almost alive.
Okay, that last bit, almost alive. That takes it somewhere else, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's beyond just chemistry.
Definitely. Warm, you could maybe guess resins, amber, heavy musks, perhaps.
Sure. But almost alive, that sounds unsettling. Like it had its own presence, its own life.
It suggests something complex, maybe even biological in its resonance. Volatility, longevity, a quality that just wasn't on the market. It hints at some kind of proprietary process, something unique to her.
And that uniqueness, that power of the scent, leads right into the power dynamic, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The fragrance wasn't just reported as pleasant. The sources claim it acted as a binding agent.
A binding agent. Okay, what does that mean? Are we talking sensationalism here? Or is this their way of trying to describe some kind of, like, psychological hold achieved through smell?
I think we have to look at binding agent as describing the effect it had on people, whatever the cause.
Right. If the perfume was that potent, that different, the reaction would be intense. The takeaway from the sources seems pretty clear on this point.
The story goes that her perfumes didn't just smell beautiful, they never left your skin.
Never left your skin. Wow.
That phrase, it apparently spread like wildfire through the town, you know, the whispering campaign. And it's our first real clue towards this whole idea of possession.
Scent becoming permanent, a possessive memory.
Exactly. It wasn't just an accessory you wash off at the end of the day. It became part of you, indelible, an eternal mark of her influence.
So if the scent never left your skin, She'd basically achieved a kind of sensory permanence, like archiving the interaction itself, which perfectly mirrors the apparent intoxication in her relationships. The product was the lure, right? The physical thing that mirrored this psychological hold she had.
She wasn't just a successful business owner.
No.
Yeah.
She was a collector, using her craft, her perfume, as the tool for the hunt.
It really lays a potent foundation for the whole dark legend that follows. Her business success, her criminal history. They're completely tangled up with this idea of eternal, non-removable possession.
And it all started with something as seemingly subtle as a signature scent.
Okay, so we move from that atmosphere she cultivated to the pattern, the cold, hard pattern that kind of established the town's uneasy silence.
The thing that let her operate for years.
Right. The records confirm it. Clara Merrow was married 7 times during that successful period in Savannah. That's the central, undeniable fact we have from the legal side.
7 times. And the really critical detail, the thing that defines the pattern, is the timing of the disappearances.
It wasn't just that she had a lot of husbands.
No. It's that each one vanished immediately after the honeymoon.
Immediately after.
That specific timing, it can't be random. It implies something organized, deliberate, maybe even ritualistic.
It feels like she used the whole structure of marriage, the excitement, the travel, that expected absence right after the wedding as cover.
Cover for erasing these men.
And this repeated action, the serial honeymoons, the instant disappearances, that's what let her fortune grow. Quietly, consistently.
Yeah, you can picture it, can't you? The townspeople seeing her wealth increase, you know, nicer dresses, the shop expanding, just subtle signs of money coming in.
Well, on the other hand, there's this growing list of missing men, men who went on honeymoons and just never came back.
The implication there is just profoundly chilling. It suggests the community, or parts of it anyway, actively chose not to ask the awkward questions.
Savannah society back then, especially in those circles, was very structured. Appearance, stability. Sometimes that mattered more than confronting something really ugly.
She must have had incredible social clout. Economic power, too.
That silence suggests the crimes, or the disappearances at least, were allowed to just flourish, unaddressed, because of that power.
And the money trail makes it obvious, right? The increasing fortune connects directly to the marriages. It feels like extraction was the point.
Each disappearance seems to signal an upgrade in her status, her holdings, reinforcing the idea that these marriages were purely transactional. Get the assets, get the capital.
And then the permanent archiving.
But why 7? You have to wonder, is there something symbolic about the number 7? Or was it just, you know, how many it took to reach whatever financial goal she had?
We can't know her motive for sure, but the sources definitely let us look at the theoretical side of this pattern.
And this is where that lens becomes crucial. The idea of a serial predation myth built from missing person cases.
Right. Was the pattern real, meticulously planned? Or did the town only connect these maybe initially separate disappearances after the fact? Because her wealth became so obvious, so unsettling.
In a small, somewhat closed off society like that, the initial gossip, then the later avoidance, that probably became the first draft of the crime story. Blurring the line between what actually happened and what everyone feared was happening.
And the longer that silence went on, the deeper the legend took root. The town avoiding it didn't just hide a crime. It, like, created the perfect conditions for the idea that Clara was untouchable.
Or maybe possessed some dark power, simply because no one dared question the pattern.
Her wealth bought her more than just things. It bought her years of operating freely. But that kind of silence, especially in a place where people know each other's business, it can't hold forever, can it?
Usually doesn't. And our next timeline snap, this is the moment it breaks. The single crucial event that shattered the town's avoidance and finally forced the police to get involved.
Let's set the mood again. It's a really stormy evening, fierce storm. You can hear the rain just pounding on the roof, splashing on the cobblestones outside the boutique.
That setting is so important. The back room, late hour, the noise of the storm covering things up, maybe no one else around. It created the perfect, or maybe imperfect, conditions for someone to see something they shouldn't.
The sounds inside were probably masked. Clara might have felt secure, you know, operating out of sight.
And the witness. It was a young delivery boy. Maybe just hanging around late, trying to stay out of the rain. Found himself near the back entrance of the shop.
And what he saw, through a gap, maybe a window, it was specific and horrifying. And it went viral instantly, you can imagine.
He peered inside, saw Clara. With what the source material describes undeniably as a man's arm, pale and limp.
Just seeing that, visceral, immediate, it transforms those vague rumors about missing men into something explicit, a crime scene.
That image alone probably would have been enough to get the police moving. But there's another concrete detail the sources give us, and this one really solidifies the whole theory of her crime.
What was it?
She wasn't just, you know, getting rid of a body part. She was seen draining something red into a crystal vial.
Oh, wow. Draining something red into a vial. That's the physical act, isn't it? The core of that love is extraction idea.
Exactly. It shows her process wasn't just disposal. It was harvesting.
She wasn't just ending a life. She was meticulously turning human essence into a component for her perfumes, blending predation with the art of perfumery.
And it ties right back to that earlier description, remember, the scent being almost alive.
Right. If she was extracting biological components, suddenly that language, permanence, vitality, it takes on this terrifyingly literal meaning.
This act of extraction becomes the physical proof for her philosophy of possession.
And the boy. He didn't just sneak away quietly.
No. The sources say he ran screaming into the street.
Screaming into the street. In the middle of a storm.
That immediate public terror, that scream cutting through the rain, it instantly crossed the line. No more quiet rumors. This was a public, verifiable criminal report.
The police had no choice now.
None. That scream basically ended 7 years of the community looking the other way, maybe complicity even. The careful veil of fear and social nicety that Clara had used to stay hidden, it just dissolved.
Giving the police the eyewitness testimony they finally needed to move beyond suspicion. Time for a raid.
So by the next morning, the rumor mill shuts down. Time for official action. Swift. Organized. The police raid the boutique, based entirely on that delivery boy's terrified account.
And what they found inside that shop, that outwardly sophisticated place, it immediately backed up the darkest versions of the legend.
The evidence described is just chilling. An overwhelming archive. Police found hundreds of bottles lined the shelves.
Hundreds. But not stored like regular shop inventory, right?
No. This sheer volume wasn't just overstock. It was physical evidence supporting the pattern, the alleged serial crimes, all just laid out.
And the labeling. That's where it gets really specific, isn't it? This is what turns the perfumery from a business into something else entirely.
A private, terrifying ledger. When you picture those shelves, the crucial detail is what was on the labels. Not scent notes, not ingredients, not batch numbers.
No. Just starkly labeled with a man's name and a date.
Each one.
It literally transforms the shop into a record, a precise chronological record of her predation. The perfume wasn't the product anymore. It was the archive of victims.
And the dates marking the moment of preservation, probably the honeymoon date or right after when the extraction happened.
It says so much about how she thought. She was documenting her collection. Methodically.
And this leads us to the psychological core of it all. The police confront her with this, all these labeled vials.
When they finally arrested her, how did she react?
Reportedly, calm, completely unfazed. She didn't deny what the labels implied. She just smiled faintly.
A faint smile. Okay. And then came the line, the one that cemented her entire horrifying legacy.
The ultimate justification for her actions, preserving her story forever.
Her chilling explanation. Apparently delivered with total composure, the quote that defines her entire worldview.
Elevated her from just a criminal to this figure of dark legend.
She stated directly, and this line, you really have to hold on to it because it explains so much. She said, you can't preserve love unless it's fresh.
That quote, it just encapsulates that whole preservation possession idea in the most twisted way possible.
She didn't see it as murder, did she? Not through a legal lens.
No, she saw it through the lens of like archival necessity. A high-level chemical process, almost, to achieve this perverse kind of eternal relationship.
But let's just pause on that word, fresh. What does that imply emotionally, physically?
It's deeply unsettling. It suggests the operation was time-sensitive, that whatever essence she was harvesting, it degraded quickly after a certain point.
Maybe after the initial intense emotional high of the relationship, the honeymoon faded.
Precisely. If freshness is the key, chemically or emotionally, then her window for extraction had to be deliberately narrow, right after that peak.
And the labels, the names, the dates, they support that idea. This whole thing was like theory two, a meticulous perfumery of evidence.
The labels acting as cold, hard trophies, detailing who she'd archived and exactly when, before their essence, as she saw it, could spoil.
She wasn't just hiding bodies. She was an archivist, treating victims like essential, time-sensitive ingredients, For a product she meant to last forever, the arrogance is staggering.
Right.
Okay, so the investigation happens. They've got the physical evidence, the labels. There's a sensational trial. And Clara Merrow is found guilty. Sentenced to life.
Right, which confirms the legal facts were established, or at least the reports of the facts were overwhelming enough for a conviction based squarely on what they found in that shop.
But to really graft how criminal her labeling system was, we need to contrast it with reality, right?
Exactly. We need a dose of cold, factual reality here. Let's introduce a pattern breaker. Standard archival practices for commercial perfumery. Even back in the 1950s when things were maybe less regulated.
They still had rules.
Absolutely. They were rigorous. Companies had to track batch numbers, where ingredients came from, potential allergens, the chemical makeup, safety notes. All for liability, for quality control.
That's the standard. Meticulous records for oversight for safety.
Correct. But Clara's inventory, it ignored all of that.
Yeah.
And key analysis here is the bottles were only labeled with names and dates.
Which proves?
It proves beyond doubt these were personal identifiers, a private timeline linked to specific victims, not commercial inventory meant for sale or regulation. The absence of the normal commercial data is, paradoxically, incredibly powerful evidence of the crime.
It takes us back to that idea we sometimes talk about, the erasure itself becomes the evidence.
Exactly. The men were erased from society, yes. But their existence and her role in their vanishing was fixed permanently in her own macabre record book.
The deliberate labeling ensured they were fixed in her personal archive, even though they were physically gone.
And that's why those labels are so terrifying. They weren't records for the authorities or for customers. They were records for her. An act of control that continued long after the crime itself, making sure the victim remained a permanent part of her collection.
The absence of the men was chillingly proven by the presence of the vials, detailing exactly who and when.
And this is where the legend and the facts kind of merge again in the public mind. Sources mention that those earlier rumors about the scents never leaving your skin, they apparently gained huge traction around the time of the trial.
Making people believe it even more strongly.
Right, cementing that idea of scent as permanent, indelible memory. It elevated her status, didn't it?
Yeah.
From just a murderer to this powerful, almost alchemical curator of human essence.
A narrative she probably didn't discourage.
Her ability to control the narrative using this respected profession, perfumery, as a cover for meticulous predation. That's key to why she's still infamous. The scent was the lure. The label was the chilling truth.
So the legal system delivers its verdict. Life sentence. Case closed, right? You'd think.
You would think. But the story of Clara Merrow just refused to stay contained within prison walls. Our next timeline snap jumps forward 20 years to 1974.
And this is where the story pivots dramatically, leaves the realm of court records and evidence, and enters the realm of pure, unsettling myth.
The scene is chaos, a huge, destructive prison fire, smoke everywhere, confusion, records lost. Bureaucratic upheaval covers the facts.
The fire itself destroyed parts of the prison, sure. But more importantly, it destroyed the evidence of her incarceration, almost mirroring how she destroyed the evidence of her victims.
And here's the absolute core fact, the one that creates the enduring, unshakable legend. She was serving life. But after the fire was out, after they sorted through the damage, nobody was recovered.
Nobody. No closure, which immediately suggests maybe she didn't die in the fire.
It suggests a chilling continuation of her story, and it directly fuels Theory 3, the prison fire escape legend.
The state can't account for her. After this huge disaster, it's the ultimate anti-closure moment.
It immediately makes people think, was she too clever? Too resourceful? Did she plan for this? Was she too well prepared to be held by a standard prison?
It reminds me of that idea how artifacts sometimes outlive their makers. Like, the prison was meant to hold her. But the legend suggests her planning, her control, extended way beyond the original crimes. Even beyond the conviction.
She becomes this shadow figure, potentially still out there, maybe even continuing her craft in secret.
That uncertainty is vital to her power as a myth, isn't it?
Absolutely. Nobody means the public imagination can run wild. Master manipulator, escape artist. It suggests her unique predatory power couldn't be contained by walls or sentences. It grants her this perverse kind of immortality through rumor and speculation.
So the conviction confirmed the crime in 54.
But the fire in 74 ensured the legend would never truly die. It leaves everyone, especially people in Savannah, with that unsettling thought, did she manage to archive herself, erase herself from the legal system, and just vanish again?
Okay, so decades go by after that fire. And the actual place where it all started, Clara Merrow's original boutique, it comes back into the story.
Finally, years later, A young couple, described as optimistic, they buy the abandoned building.
Symbolizing a fresh start, right? Complete contrast to the shop's dark history. They start renovating, breaking through old walls, literally trying to clean the slate, sanitize the space for something new.
And that process, the renovation, the disturbance, it leads directly to a discovery, something physical that just yanks the past right into the present.
What did they find?
They found a hidden cache, a secret storage space concealed deep inside the building structure. And inside, dozens of vials still sealed.
Still sealed. Oh, wow. So this is undeniable proof. Her planning, her meticulousness,
yeah,
it went way beyond her arrest, beyond the fire.
This suggests contingency planning on a whole other level.
If the shelves found in the first raid were her archives of the past, the seven husbands, then this hidden cache, this was her preparation for the future.
It shows she believed she might return, or maybe that her work needed to continue even if she didn't.
The fact they were sealed is critical too, isn't it?
Incredibly important. They weren't being used, they were waiting. Preserved with the same obsessive care she apparently applied to her victims.
And among them, there was one final chilling message, something that spoke directly to the future.
The ultimate revelation. Delivered by the label on one specific vial, standing out from the rest, it read, "For my next groom."
For my next groom. Chilling.
This is really the synthesis of the whole deep dive, isn't it? This final vial proves her mission, as she saw it, was fundamentally incomplete.
The plan went beyond the trial, the sentence, even her supposed death in the fire.
The treasure, this bottled essence, it was just waiting. A potential, perfectly preserved trap laid for the future. It's like a literal inheritance of malice, left for the next unsuspecting man who might stumble into the story.
Her foresight confirms just how deep that possession motif ran. She wasn't just collecting husbands. She was archiving the idea of possession itself, ensuring her influence could last indefinitely.
Even gone, potentially dead, she was still trying to exert control over the future, over whoever found that cache. Hashtag tag tag outro, Aka.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, we come back to those three core ideas that really structure this deeply disturbing story.
Scent as memory, love as extraction.
And possession as preservation.
Yeah. And the knowledge we get from looking at this case, it isn't just about the timeline, the disappearances, the fire. It's about understanding how the myth itself was crafted, meticulously. Almost chemically, you could say, right alongside the crime.
And what really stands out, maybe for you listening, is that terrifying detail.
Mm.
The legend lasts not just because the crime was brutal, but because of the planning, the meticulous preparation, the archiving for the future.
She left behind a permanent record and a pre-labeled weapon, just waiting.
Waiting for someone to find it.
Exactly. It's the waiting, the anticipation, that permanent archiving of her intent that really chills you. Because, you know, some fragrances, they're volatile, they fade.
Hers waited?
Hers waited on a shelf with the name already written.
A single pristine vial labeled, "For my next room."